This is Pacifica Radio's Letters in Politics. On today's show,
it's me, Richard Wolff, and I'm going to start and I'm going to say a few words about, you'll never guess, the surprise of the day, Donald Trump, and what he means and what the economics of it all amounts to.
That is coming up next, and that is The Voice Live, as we do an intro live here with Richard Wolff, who joins me here in the studio. Of course, Richard Wolff is a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, as well as a professor in the graduate program in the international affairs of the New School University in New York. He is the author of a number of books, including Capitalism's Crisis Deepens. And many of you know Richard Wolff for his radio program, Economic Update. So coming up in the next hour, we'll be in conversation about this moment in time in our political life and our economic life, and maybe even talk about what may it look like on the other side of this moment. That's next on Letters in Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Amnesty International has condemned toxic fear-mongering by world leaders, notably Donald Trump and the leaders of Turkey, Hungary, and the Philippines. Amnesty says in its annual report on human rights abuses that 2016 was the year when the cynical use of us versus them narratives of blame, hate, and fear took on a global prominence to a level not seen since the 1930s when Adolf Hitler rose to power in Germany. Secretary General of Amnesty, Celio Shetty, appeared on Al Jazeera.
You've had a shocking rise in political leaders last year who have used fear and hate to capture power, to create divisions in society. And this is, you know, panned out across the world in so many countries. Of course, the most talked about case right now is President Trump, but it's not restricted to them. And the way in which they go about doing this is by whipping up nationalistic, hyper-nationalistic sentiments and scapegoating.
Amnesty said in 2016, governments around the world turned a blind eye to war crimes, pushed through deals that undermine the right to claim asylum, passed laws that violate free expression, incited murder of people simply because they're accused of using drugs, justified torture and mass surveillance, and extended draconian police powers. Up to 300 people remain at an encampment near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in the last hours before today's 2 p.m. deadline to leave. The Army Corps of Engineers has ordered the camp closed, citing the danger of impending spring floods. Some of the water protectors opposing the Dakota Access oil pipeline have said they will not go. The Standing Rock Sioux tribe is asking for no forcible removal of the water protectors. They're calling it resistance recess. The new Congress is on its first recess, taking advantage of the long President's Day weekend. Opponents of the Trump administration and the Republican congressional agenda are in the streets and at town hall meetings. Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa had this exchange with a constituent over the Affordable Care Act.
I haven't seen you for a long time. How are you doing?
Oh, I've been busy. I'm on Obamacare. Yes. If it wasn't for Obamacare, we wouldn't be able to afford insurance. With all due respect, sir, you're the man that talked about the death penalty.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Right. We're going to create one great big death penalty in this country that people can't afford to get insurance. Don't repeal Obamacare. Improve it.
Mayors around the country are taking part in a Mayor's Day of Action for the Affordable Care Act. They're hosting virtual phone banks where residents can seek out contact information for their congressional representatives. In the San Francisco Bay Area, the Richmond City Council has become the first in the nation to call for the impeachment of Donald Trump. At last night's meeting, council member and former mayor Gail McLaughlin noted 1 million people nationwide have signed an impeachment petition. McLaughlin cited the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, which prohibits presidents from accepting gifts from any foreign nation. Critics point to Trump's far-reaching business interests.
This resolution is basically stating that we as the city council
call upon the U.S. House of Representatives to support a resolution authorizing and directing the House Committee on the Judiciary to investigate whether sufficient grounds exist for the impeachment of Donald J. Trump, President of the United States, including but not limited to the violations that I mentioned earlier in terms of emoluments.
The city council says it will urge other cities to adopt similar impeachment resolutions. Los Angeles Congresswoman Maxine Waters has let loose against top officials of the Trump administration. She pointed to a measure Trump signed repealing an Obama-era rule that forced energy and mining companies to disclose any foreign payments they made. Waters said Trump has surrounded himself with cabinet and other top officials tied to the oil industry.
And don't forget the second executive order that was signed by the president, that was 1504, yep, which basically would undo the work that we had done with Dodd-Frank in making these oil companies disclose the money that they were using to bribe these countries with in Africa and other places. Why are they all in this administration? And I just think the American people had better understand what's going on. This is a bunch of scumbags. That's what they are.
Maxine Waters. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. Richard Wolff is here, well known to our listeners. Richard Wolff is a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst. And he's also a professor in the graduate program, International Affairs of the New School University in New York. He's the author of a number of books. His latest is called Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. He is a founder of Democracy at Work. Of course, you can find more about Richard Wolff online at rdwolff.com. And also, he is host of our very popular radio program, Economic Update. Richard Wolff, it is always good to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mitch. Glad to be here.
And you have an event tonight for KPFA, and I'll give those details a little bit later in the program. So if folks want to see you tonight. You know, we've had a number of conversations over the years, and I've enjoyed all of them. And but there's one that has always stood out to me about a year ago, and I got a lot of feedback from listeners from it. And it's when it was just after the Brexit vote, when the UK voted to leave the European Union. And the analysis you gave me was pretty profound. And that was, this is, I don't know if we say the beginning, but at least a major step towards the unraveling of this post-World War II world global order, whatever it is. And that was before the election of Donald Trump.
Yes, well, I guess I should say I told you so or something like that. But
you also warned us in 2009 about the rise of populism and right-wing populism, never mind left-wing.
Yeah, I think the left wing is coming too. So for those of you who want balance, it's not that far behind. In the early time, 2009 and 10, after the crisis hit, everyone was noticing that the Europeans were in the streets all the time. General strikes in Greece, yeah, it seemed, every few months. Then Italy, then all of Europe had one. And everyone was asking, well, why is it not happening in the United States? And I remember saying to people, since the conditions are fundamentally very similar, the only reasonable influence and inference from the situation is that it will happen in the United States. And then the question is really only, why is it taking so long? Well, we now know that it happened in the United States. It happened first in 2011 with Occupy Wall Street, and then it happened.
What about the Tea Party before that? I mean, does that count?
The Tea Party, well, I meant on the left.
Yeah. No,
the
I
Tea
understand
Party
that,
comes on the right, but yeah, absolutely the Tea Party was an earlier manifestation of the same disgruntled sense that masses of people were being pushed out of the so-called American dream opportunity.
And every time I mention the Tea Party, I'll get emails from people saying, well, this was an AstroTurf group funded by big money, the Koch brothers. And I believe that's true, but I don't believe that's the only factor.
That's right. The Koch brothers were able to see something that they could,
yeah,
shape, but it was there before they saw it, and it has dimensions they've never liked. Just like Trump is something that comes out of a larger situation, which the Koch brothers didn't like at first, but are now making accommodations with.
Their ticket.
Yeah, basically. It's their ride. Anyway, the left, I thought, would emerge. It did in 2011 with Occupy. It did again on a much bigger scale in the support for Bernie Sanders all of last year. And so I'm convinced that the really interesting question was all along, why would it take longer in the United States than it did in Europe, since the impact here was just as terrible in a way? And I think the answer is the very different history since World War II, that in the United States, the left was systematically crushed. The government, big business, small business, everything from the John Birch Society on one extreme on over to the liberal establishment on the other in our politics could agree on one thing, and that is to demonize everything left of center, socialism, communism, all the rest. The story I like to tell that summarizes it is that if you know much about Europe, you know that in all European societies, if you ask a person to tell you the difference between a socialist and a communist and an anarchist, every school child can do that because it's part of the community. Here in the United States, I remember being shocked when I first started teaching that most of my students saw the words socialist, Marxist, communist, anarchist as synonyms, that there was no difference among them. And at first I thought that was a problem of education, but I realized later it isn't. It's because in our society at the end of World War II, first the communists, then the socialists, then everybody left of anywhere, were simply put into the same pot, tarred with the same evil, and therefore made synonymous in terms of the way the politics dealt with them. And so we have a longer way to reconstruct a left here in the United States. But right now, it is crystal clear to me that the best and biggest organizer for the left in the United States is the capitalist breakdown on the one hand, and Mr. Trump as a manifestation of that on the other. They are motivating and mobilizing people in a way that the left itself could never have done.
You are known as one of our foremost scholars on Karl Marx. What do you think Marx would say about the condition of America now? And, well, maybe more specifically, what do you think Marx would say? And, of course, who knows for sure, right? Maybe by now he'd become a conservative who's still alive. But what would Marx say about the election of Donald Trump?
I think he would have an immense ironic grin on his face. That he would be looking and saying to us, this is a system that I told you back in the 19th century was riven by internal contradictions, that it did things out of its normal way of functioning that would undermine it, that it was its own worst enemy. And he would say the two biggest problems of the system that keep provoking it are instability and inequality. It can't function without having an economic downturn every 3 to 7 years, which indeed has been the case, punctuated occasionally by those downturns that are terrible, last a long time, cut very deep, like the one we're in since 2008, like the one in 1929, and that this instability would drive people to question the system and eventually decide they could and should do better. And that the other internal contradiction besides this instability was inequality, that it was a system that generated unequal outcomes and then allowed those unequal outcomes to become even more unequal over time, and that in the end, the tiny number of people who would gather the bulk of the wealth into their hands would have no choice, especially in a society that has universal suffrage where everybody can vote. The people at the top, the concentrated wealth, would have no choice but to corrupt the political system, to basically undo the democracy because it's too dangerous for their wealth position, since the mass of people aren't stupid and would eventually realize that what they control, the ballot box, the majority, could be used to undo the inequality of the capitalist system, and they would proceed in that direction. In order to prevent that, you have to control the politics. So here we are, Marx says, with a modern-day capitalism, led by the United States, in which instability is now fomenting grief and trouble, and the inequality magnifies it all. So we've come to a kind of unraveling of the system. And if I had a moment, I would say that that unraveling has already provoked first a slightly left of center, that's Obama, and then a right of center, that's Mr. Trump. Each in their way designed to distract, to deflect, to make this system as it goes through its, what the British would call, rough patch, able to survive. And the way to do that, since neither Obama nor Trump are willing to deal with the basic problems, the instability, the inequality, they're not touching that. So what they do instead is distract us with one kind of event after another, a foreign war, maybe two or three, now this immigration crusade as if it's going to solve our problems, or making border adjustments so you can't bring goods in from Mexico. These are all marginal. They're not going to change the basic problem, but they keep us from facing it and dealing with it. And that's, I think, what Obama's function was to the left. And now Trump.
Well, that's interesting because I think we see Trump as this radical presence, but what you just said is that he has the same purpose as Obama, and that is to keep this capitalist system in place.
That's right. And he has none of the polish of Mr. Obama. He has none of the suave kind of elegant speaking. He's not a dynamic young African-American to get that kind of...
But he's interesting to watch.
Yes, he is.
But Mr. he's Trump, a reality TV show.
Mr. Trump? Yeah, no, Mr. Trump is... You know, uncouth, he's gross, but that's another kind of distraction. And he's all excited about, instead of us being angry at China and friendly to Russia, we're going to be angry at Russia and friendly to China, or vice versa. These are not the issues that this economy has to deal with. They are distractions, and they are, as our whole politics has so often been, weapons of mass distraction.
So are we at a moment of crisis? It feels like to me we are, and the way I see it, and I'll give you the full rein to respond, but the way I see it, we're at a crisis concerning our political institutions. We're at a crisis concerning the press, and there are big questions of what things look like on the other side of this moment in time.
No, I agree we're at a crisis. For me, these are all symptoms of a society that's having more and more trouble functioning in the way it got used to after World War II, with comfortable alternations between slightly center-left Democrats and slightly center-right Republicans, following one another in an almost boring litany of sameness. I think Mrs. Clinton's rejection at the polls was the beginning of a process of, kind of saying no more of those. As the Tea Party and now Trump have kind of pushed those folks out of the Republican limelight, it's a sign. But again, I would argue that Obama was also, that African Americans have been kept out of high position, as everybody knows in this society, to suddenly say, no, here's an opportunity for an African American to be president, was a sign that something was amiss, that the people who normally prevented that from happening saw now that this is something that needs to be done, because it will get everybody left of center excited, moved, often for good reasons, but therefore not questioning the basic system, looking for this left of center to do its thing. He did enough of them, but the problem was Mr. Obama didn't deal with the underlying problem, which came back. Didn't bite him because he can't run again, but it bit his alter ego, Hillary Clinton, and she could not recover from it. And now Mr. Trump is going to do a more extreme version on the right of what Mr. Obama did on the left. And that's, again, consistent with America, because we permit right-wing politics a much freer rein than we have ever permitted left-wing politics, especially since the Second World War. And so the right-wing can go further, quicker, sooner, in a more extreme fashion. And that's what we're going to see now. And the business community will let Mr. Trump go if he can keep the thing controlled, keep the lid on the situation.
Which is not clear.
Not yet clear at all. And if he were to falter, and if he were either to falter in the sense that the underlying economic troubles become more extreme, or that he provokes a reaction on the left that makes government dysfunctional, then they'll get rid of him as quickly as he emerged, you know, on the scene, because his function is to distract, not to basically change anything. And if he can't do that effectively, then we'll have what my students have referred to as pants on fire.
Well, I do wonder about that. I'm sure there are some Republicans right now very concerned because they have all the keys to the House and have all the power, especially if they get, you know, if Gorsuch gets confirmed, which is a big question on the Supreme Court. Now you got all three major branches of government, your time's now. And I do think demographics are changing in a way where it doesn't look good in the long term for the Republican Party. So this is somewhat your time. And the question you mentioned, if things become so ungovernable, this could be a wasted moment for Republicans. But then what, you get Mike Pence?
Yeah, you get Mike Pence, and the problem there is that that looks like, I don't know, a cross between the traditional Republican and Mr. Trump,
yeah.
And why that should be more acceptable than Mr. Trump is hard to see.
He won't throw flaming bombs, I suppose.
No, but particularly on a number of social issues.
I mean, yeah.
On a number of social issues, he's to the right of Mr. Trump.
Yeah. And,
but let me be real clear with your audience. There is an enormous array of businesses that are already unhappy with what Mr. Trump is doing. He is going to have a growing problem with these businesses, whether it's because they rely on immigrant labor and all that that implies, high-skilled immigrant labor, low-skilled immigrant labor, or whether it's people who have invested hundreds of billions of dollars in foreign production facilities to cater to the U.S. market and are not about to be told. That all has to be written off. He has to deal with all of that. Having riled up the defense and intelligence communities, he has to deal with the people who have vested interests in our traditional enemies who don't want to give that up. These are enormous problems, and given the chaos of his administration, it's not at all clear that this will all be manageable.
Yeah. We are in conversation with Richard Wolff. Many know Richard Wolff from his radio program and many other things, but particularly his radio program, Economic Update, of course, a professor emeritus of economics University of Massachusetts Amherst, as well as the New School, New York City, and author of a number of books. For our listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area, Richard Wolff will be speaking tonight at the First Presbyterian Church, which is at 2407 Dana in Berkeley. So that is tonight at 7:30 p.m. The First Presbyterian Church, 2407 Dana in Berkeley. You know, we usually have you in the First Congregational Church in Berkeley, but it had a fire,
I understand.
Damaged the roof or something.
Yes.
Yeah, really upsetting.
Yeah.
But anyways, this will be at the First Presbyterian Church in Berkeley, and we're happy to be able to do that there. We'll get those details again later. Before we continue on, let me just take a quick moment here. Today is this radio program's second day of our winter 2017 fund drive, and this is the time that I have to come to you seeking a financial contribution that allows us to be able to do the work that we do here. And my promise to you this hour has been that as long as we're able to get near our goal, in fact, yesterday we went over it a little bit. I was very happy about that. I think that was when I told them, folks, we got to make our goal if we're going to have Richard Wolff on tomorrow. It helped very much. We also had George Lakoff in here that I think people liked a lot as well. But in order for us to be able to do this, and we need what I'm calling a pure donation. No bells, no whistles, no fancy thank you gifts. I'm asking you to support this radio program and this radio station because that's how public broadcasting works. It is a long tradition that began here where I'm broadcasting from, KPFA in Berkeley, back in 1949. It's a tradition. It's an American tradition that of public broadcasting, and one that I can get, that I can really get behind. And I hope you will do so as well. So we do have a goal of $5,000 this hour. It's reasonable considering we're on both here in KPFA. We're also on in KPFK in Los Angeles live right now as well. So we're in KFCF in Fresno. So we are on across the state. There's really no reason we can't do it, but it's going to take everyone to call in and pledge what you can afford. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. Your donation, and we look at the zip code where the contribution comes in from, and if it's from Southern California, well, your donation will go to your station, KPFK. Otherwise, your donation will go to KPFA up here. So again, 1-800-439-5732 or online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. And it's interesting, Richard Wolf, at our station KPFA, where we're in the studios here in Berkeley, I actually began this with your program, Economic Update, on Fridays, and I started approaching this of trying not to offer any thank you gifts, but just ask people to pledge because that's the right thing to do, and that's the best way that you can help this radio station really at an important time. And it worked on an Economic Update, and it's starting to work. Some days are better than others on this hour as well, on this day.
If I could just add a word, the Trump election, the craziness of the last few weeks coming out of Washington, the longer-term growth of inequality and trouble and tea parties and populism and all the other ways, whatever else you think about them, these are times of big change. And at a time of big change in a society where questions are asked that had been taboo for half a century before, nothing could be more important than having some genuinely independent and courageous public media sources like KPFA, KPFK, the whole Pacifica operation. These are unbelievably important institutions at this particular time. So if you've never contributed before, let me make the argument, now is the time to do it. Give these stations a chance to present the kinds of thinking and analysis that can make a real difference at a time of change. People are asking questions like never before. They're considering new and different ways of building a society. They need stations like this, programs like this, the willingness to do this kind of public media work. So I am proud to be part of it. I'm excited to be part of it. But your funding is crucial to enable the rest of us to do all of this and to make the kind of difference that's now possible. So I could not be more enthusiastic and supportive of the fundraising time this time around. And I'm glad to be part of it.
And I thank you for saying that. Again, the number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. Let's dive in to the issue of immigration. And I think it's appropriate to talk to you about the issue of immigration. The Department of Homeland Security has issued new guidelines that will extend what it means to commit a crime. Basically, it would mean even if you were here as an undocumented person, that would be a crime, right? Expedited removal. It'll expand that for people who have been here for 2 years or under, which, you know, so some serious questions. I'm sure there'll be some legal challenge concerning people's rights to the writ of a habeas corpus. But I think it's very appropriate to talk to you about this, Richard Wolf, in part because this is actually the way Donald Trump formulates it, a part of his economic plan.
Yeah, well, the first thing to say is to remind everyone of history. Leaders who suddenly decide that the great economic problem of their era is immigrants, this is as old a ploy in politics as there is. You can find it thousands of years ago, hundreds of years ago, in every corner of the world. Beating up on immigrants who tend to be poor people, driven either by economic essential crisis or by political intolerable conditions. So these are poor, hunted people who search for a way to live. And to turn on them is the sort of cheap political gambit that leaders have endlessly resorted to because it's an easy way out. It distracts people from all the suffering they feel and has someone convenient to blame. Here in the United States, we have had a growing inequality of income for 40 years without interruption. To blame this on immigrants is ridiculous, silly, has no warrant whatsoever.
Well, let's get into that, because the argument is that undocumented immigrants who work here lower wages in general.
Sure. These are one of these wonderful stories. If you have immigrants coming into the United States, other things equal, yes, and they're desperate, and yes, if they're desperate, they offer to work for less money, and the employer sees an opportunity because an undocumented immigrant is someone you can forget to pay on Friday, who dare not go to the police. Yeah, you can see the opportunities for a corrupt abuse of all kinds of labor laws in the country. And does that happen? Yes, it happens. But let's keep a perspective. We are a country of 330 million people. And we're talking about illegal immigrants who number 10 or 20 million out of 330. So before you do any wild hallucinations about the impact of 10 to 20 million on an economy of 330 million, keep your perspective. Otherwise, you're going to be susceptible to manipulators who turn a situation that affects a small number of people and use it to explain an enormous economic situation, number one. Number two, why are people coming here? There's a wonderful notion that this is some kind of lark, that this is some kind of adventure. People do not leave the places they were born in, the languages they know how to speak, the neighbors and relatives with whom they live their lives, the cultural institutions, the churches, the schools where their children are going, where they were baptized, whatever it is. They don't do that easily. Let me put myself on the line here. My parents were refugee immigrants to the United States. So I admit I have a special feeling for this since it's my own personal history. But my parents, who came from France and Germany, would never have come to the United States if they had not been forced literally to run for their lives. They didn't want to do that.
What were they running from?
The Second World War, basically. Yeah. Nazism, fascism, Hitler, all of that. And because the war was fought on the borders, really, between France and Germany, if not inside those countries, they had to leave or else they would be caught literally in the crossfire. So they came to the United States and because they wanted to survive. Now, it might be said that the United States has some role to play in this. It would be very hard to argue that it wasn't. Most of the people we're talking about now either come from Latin America, that's the overwhelming majority, or now increasingly from other parts of the world. But it's easy to show that the economic development of these other parts of the world has been impacted by the activities of American corporations aided by the American government that turned their local societies into operations to make a great deal of wealth for a very small number of people, producing coffee or sugar or cheap manufactures for delivery to the United States. In other words, the economic and political conditions in those societies are also the result of the United States. We are not some innocent bystander suffering an influx of people whom we have no relationship to until they arrive. That might be a convenient way of understanding it, but it makes no economic or historical sense. So if you have even the smallest sense of compassion, but also of responsibility for all of this, then you see migration for what it is. It's a failure of the system. If capitalism had developed more evenly, shared some of the wealth it was able to produce with the people in Africa, Asia, and Latin America who did a lot of the work.
How easy would that be to do that? Is that so easy? I mean, it sounds good. I like it. I'm for it.
Well, give you an example. Americans actually already understand this a little bit. Here's a little microcosm. You can go to a place and buy a pound of coffee. Or you can go to another store and buy a pound of something called fair traded coffee. And the whole idea of fair trade is you pay a few pennies more per pound of the coffee, and then you make sure that the guy who grows the coffee in Colombia or wherever it is gets a better price than could be squeezed out of him or her by the normal mechanisms of trade. Well, come on. We're able to do that. We could do that across the board. And if we did, and if we also made the effort to say, hey, in your society, the distribution of wealth is so crazy, so unequal, that you're creating misery for masses of people who don't even need to have that misery, and we would be interested in helping you out of the self-interest that we don't want an influx, this wouldn't be that hard to sell to the American people at all. But the effort has to be made. And the effort wasn't made. Let's be real honest. The flow of immigrants to this country is based on the notion I can get a job. And the people who dispense jobs for immigrants in this society are capitalist employers who want that opportunity because those people are cheap to employ. The same logic that led some businesses to go abroad to take advantage of cheap labor leads other businesses who can't go abroad to bring the labor, the cheap labor here. If you're growing crops in California, you need cheap labor here.
You're not going to export that.
That's right. Yeah. And if you need someone to do the dishes in the restaurant and to do all that kind of work that can't be exported, well, then you got to bring the cheap labor here.
And hence the argument, though, we got to stop people who are willing to work for that cheap labor from coming here so that those jobs would be available for Americans.
Well, that could be an argument, but that only means that you've accepted the notion that we have to persuade businesses to behave in a decent way. The alternative is to say,
so we're punishing the worker.
That's right. Yeah. Why not say, look, you're the employer. You have a choice to make. You want to employ an immigrant, that's fine, but you can't do it at subhuman conditions. You can't do that, and if you start to do that, we will really intervene and stop. That might mean for the immigrant that they can't come here because they won't hire them, but my guess is they probably would because they could get still advantages out of the desperation of those folks to make it in a new country, to work very hard, to avoid having to go back to what they came from, etc. But there are always multiple ways of solving a problem. Here what we've done is said, capitalists, you want to make a lot of money? Here, hire undocumented immigrants. Do it for 30 years. Then when the mass of local native people get so angry they won't let you anymore, okay, then we'll throw them out. And by the way, the incentive will be, if you throw them back out, and if they're all gathered in Mexico or Central America, American companies will discover that they're willing to work there for next to nothing, because that's the situation you're building, so they will have a greater incentive to leave. The very thing that we complained about under globalization, companies leaving, is being incentivized by the expulsion of immigrants. And if you shut that off, you say your immigrant can't come here and products produced abroad can't come here, then you're going to create in the United States the need for corporations to hire only domestic Americans. That will drive up the wage. And what does that do in capitalism? It leads to what we call automation. You've created an incentive by rising wages to substitute robots and computers and machines. The problem is the system.
Yeah.
The worker is going to get the short end of the stick, whether it be by immigration, whether it be by relocating facilities out of the country, or by automating. And until you take this situation in hand and realize it's a system that works this way, all you're going to be doing is going from one way of getting screwed to another. You're not dealing with the system that's screwing you.
Again, we are speaking to Richard Wolf. For our listeners in the Bay Area, he'll be speaking tonight at Berkeley at the First Presbyterian Church, which is at 2407 Dana Street, and that is tonight at 7:30. Again, First Presbyterian Church in Berkeley. We'll get those details as we wrap up the program at the top of the hour. I do want to give a quick fundraising update at this moment. Professor Wolf, we are at about $1,500 towards that $5,000 goal. So, and that's good news, except, so, I mean, what's 15 of 5,000? It's like 30%, 35%, somewhere around there, right? That's how you economists do it. You just estimate, right? Anyways, but we're two-thirds of the way through through the program. So we got to pick it up a little bit here. And what we are doing is we are asking you again for what we call a pure donation. You're supporting this radio program, so to support it, you're supporting this radio station and the effort that this radio station, radio network does in order to keep it on the air so that we can have these type of conversations. Look, $25 pledge will make you a basic member to this radio station. If you can afford $50, we need to average about $100 in order for us to be able to reach our overall goal at the end of the hour. But, you know, that means everyone doing their part. Somebody who's pledging $25, well, that's a big deal to that person who's pledging $25. But it might be, if we don't want to talk about equivalency, because here we are in the Bay Area, we know there's quite a bit of wealth around here. For some people, that would probably be like making a $500 pledge or a $1,000 pledge. Really what we're doing is we're asking you right now to make a donation of what's reasonable for you. I want you to feel good about it, that you think this is what we are deserving from. I want this to be a good, positive relationship. And I'm hoping you'll go to your phones and give us a call, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. Many people to thank. Let me begin here with Susan in Berkeley. Thank you so much. Mauro in Albany. Rose in Berkeley. Greg in Alhambra. Diana in Berkeley. Joan in Oahu. You know, sometimes I get some of the, you know, every time I do one of these things, my geography, my ignorance in geography shows, and I'm embarrassed oftentimes. But nonetheless, Joan, very appreciative of you. And finally, Mary in Petaluma. So that's where we are. $1,500, $3,500 to go.
Well, you know, I live in Manhattan, which is perhaps one of the richest concentrations of people on this planet. And I'm struck. I'm a little jealous, and I'm struck by the fact that it seems to me that on the other end of the political spectrum, there is often a better understanding of those at the tippity top that they need to spend freely to make sure that their perspectives remain in control in this society. And I know I'm not the only one who was struck by the Bernie Sanders phenomena, that he proved in a way that no amount of argument could, that there is one way to confront concentrated wealth, and that's if a huge number of people give a little bit. Because the huge number multiplied by the little bit begins to confront the tiny number with huge amounts of wealth. And it worked to make Bernie a real phenomena in this election and to change American history as a result. And it can work that way here. It can mean that if you have a little bit, you don't shy away. You're not embarrassed. You know that lots of people with a little bit can do amazing things. And there is no better way to take a little bit and make it mean something than to enable this kind of a radio station, this kind of a programming model that you have in KPFA and KPFK and the others to keep them going. So please do your part. Help out. Let the people at the top know that an awful lot of us are prepared to put our proverbial money where our commitments lie.
And the truth is, if we fail, this is a very valuable radio signal, and there will be a commercial interest ready to gobble up that 94.1 FM if we were to lose it.
Right, and try to make us be angry at immigrants.
That's right. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. I want to ask you a question about a thought I have, because it's all about me now, on immigration. And we always look at it, at the issue in humanitarian terms, but I want to look at it as an economic term. And I get that there are three people I like talking to most: historians, economists, and demographers. And I find demographers interesting. And this seed of an idea was given to me by a demographer who I interviewed once, who was telling me, look, there are issues about the future of our social welfare programs. Right, or social safety nets, Social Security, Medicare. These are serious issues. You had a baby boom, you didn't have as many people behind it, these type of things. Yet, you actually have 11 million people in this country right now who are not recognized, Well, you can basically, you know, you bring them into the fold. You bring them into the society. So as we have Paul Ryan and all these people talking about we have to cut Social Security, we have to cut Medicare, we have to reform these things. Not everyone who, you know, will keep it intact for people who are about to get on it, but people before that, you know, it'll be means tested, all these type of things, right? And we have to. We have no choice. Well, maybe we do have a choice. I mean, I'm sure there are many choices, but one way that we can address this, and it's not based in a humanitarian argument or a moral argument. It's based in really our own self-interest, actually, to bring these folks out of the shadows into society, remove the obstacles for them to be successful, and then participate. And you know, they will fill in the gap that we're missing to move forward.
Absolutely, and this has always been true. That's why I started with the history of not being taken in by yet another leader, so-called, finding it politically convenient to beat up on immigrants. Let me talk for a minute as an economist. Most human beings in a society like ours take an enormous amount of resources to get to the point when they can become productive and give back. So when you're an infant, when you're a toddler, when you're a little child, the society pours resources. It feeds you, it clothes you, it shelters you, then it educates you for 20 years up to through high school and maybe beyond to college. And then finally, after an enormous investment has been put into you, an enormous cost to the society, you begin to give back. Well, now compare that to an immigrant. Most immigrants come as young adults. That's what most immigrants are, which means the cost of developing whatever skills they have has been borne by another country, not by this one. We get the benefit of their productive years, and we don't have to pay the cost of getting them ready for their productive years. That's a subsidy that Guatemala or Mexico or Nicaragua or Uruguay, that's subsidy of those societies who can't afford it to the United States, which doesn't need it. It's a perverse economic flow. And the United States owes, in an honest sense, the fact that it has the benefit of the productivity of young adults crossing into the country, legally or otherwise, because the cost of their education, the cost of their upbringing, all of the time that they took without giving was borne by another country far away.
I never hear that argument being.
But it ought to be made because it's very real. And let me tell you, 20 years of food, clothing, shelter, and education is a lot more wealth poured into those people than any period of 6 months or a year that they go on unemployment or anything else that they're able to get here. That's a small part of what has already been saved for the United States by the reality of what immigrants are and what they bring. An honest discussion of immigrants and the problems they bring and the assets they bring, the benefits and the costs, is what Mr. Trump has never engaged in. What this is not about. This is not an honest engagement with what do we get from immigrants, what does it cost us, how could we manage it better, all of which are perfectly reasonable questions. This is an attempt for scapegoating, pure and simple. It's like advertising something. You don't talk about its costs and benefits. You talk about what's good about it. You hide everything that's bad about it in order to get money out of a public's pocket to buy whatever it is you sell. That's not honest communication. That's advertising. The scapegoating of immigrants is not an honest discussion of a social issue. It's a scapegoating problem so that we don't ask, why do we run the society the way we do?
Yeah, as an economist, I want you to be honest with me about my idea here. You can even shoo it away that I mentioned earlier, because I think about this a lot. And again, it's this idea of who's going to take care of this aging population that we have. Well, it's here. But we're treating it horribly, right? We're going to be taking care of people by people whose parents or who themselves were treated quite poorly. It's actually in our interest. I'm not even talking about morality here. It's in our self-preservation, our self-interest to remove obstacles for the people who are here to succeed.
Absolutely. In an honest discussion, you would say, look, if we have a population bubble, which we do because of the baby booms, if we now have a huge number of people becoming needy in the sense of cashing in on their Social Security, and we don't have a follow-up generation producing the output, the wealth that can be passed to the older ones, then immigrants are absolutely playing an important role in our society. They keep working and putting money into the social system, social safety net system, so that the older ones can do it. And again, if you had an honest discussion of immigration, that would be one of the benefits to the United States of having adults who don't need anything out of the system arrive here as adults so they can put into the system not only what they themselves earn, but the extras that become available for a whole host of social programs. Yes, absolutely. You're on to something that is important. And in any honest discussion of immigration, for that matter, any other labor issue, would be listed as the costs and benefits and what we have to deal with to make it work better.
Another quick fundraising update. 9.5 minutes remaining in the hour. We're now at $2,500 for this hour.
That's so a good boost.
We're halfway there, but we have 9.5 minutes to go. Now, this is commonly how it works. We normally do raise a bit more in the final 10 minutes, but we still need to be able to make that happen, my friends. Again, what we're doing, and this is what allows me to do this, is to be able to still have a regular show, to have, I think, important conversations. You know, I never even really thought about who put in that other countries put in already the resources to get somebody to a working age for us. I've never even thought about that before. And I feel like these conversations are very important. Tomorrow we're going to be in conversation with Stephen Kinzer about the history of empire in this country, but only if we can continue to make our goals, my friend. And I'm asking for a pure donation, whatever you can afford. And again, for some folks, and I'm looking at the board here, Richard Wolf, we got a number of $25 pledges, a number of $30 pledges. We got a $500 pledge, a $300 pledge. That's how it works. But we need everyone to participate to make this happen. So we're halfway towards that $5,000 goal. The number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. I do want to thank Rose in Redwood City and Bill in Redwood City and Kate in Occidental and Marilyn and Mill Valley, Edward in San Francisco and Bernice in Fresno. Thank you all. So we're going to continue with our conversation. So please get your calls in. Help us. You know, I got Richard Wolf. I would hate not to make it with Richard Wolf here with me in the studio. That would be, I'd be embarrassed.
Yes, I'll be hanging my head in shame and agony.
It's my fault.
Please, yes.
No. It would be my fault. What do you think of what's going to happen with the economy here moving forward?
I don't see any solution to the problems that this country has. That means, sure, magical things could happen. Suddenly changes in other parts of the world could have big impacts here, positive or negative. So that you never know. No one can see the future, and I can't either. But you see now an accumulation of problems, the recovery that has bypassed most Americans, the inequality that continues to get worse, and no doubt will under a Trump who's literally a model of inequality. So the basic problems of instability and inequality and the injustice that flow from them, the manipulation of our politics by the folks at the top who need to do that to stay at the top, I don't see any of those basic problems being addressed. Not in discussion, not in policy, certainly not by this government or the Congress, the executive or the congressional branches. So I see trouble. I see a continuing deterioration, and the hope that was put into Obama, which faded, will be matched by the hope in Trump, which will fade. And I don't know where that's going to lead and how badly we are going to have to veer off any kind of political normalcy as this system goes through its unraveling, and or how far that will go, I don't think anyone can tell you.
And a clear sign of I'm aging now as well. And I as a young man in my 20s, 20 years ago, I was very much for bringing down the system and tearing it down. And I still recognize that the system is deeply flawed. And maybe this is why, maybe when people get older, they get a little more conservative. I don't know. But what I'm about to say is this. I also recognize even the unraveling, the destruction of a deeply flawed system does not guarantee something better on the other side of that.
No, that's up to us. That's up to the people who listen to programs like this, who care, who contribute some of their money, even when they don't have much. That's what'll shape the outcome. All I can tell you, though, is we need to fund this program and we need to become active. And I am very heartened, just as one observer, that on the left in America today, I think you'd have to say that the biggest and best organizer for the left today is Mr. Trump. That's how these things work. As the system unravels and has to turn to more and more extreme efforts to hold it together, you are teaching people that this is a system that needs extremes to hold it together, and that raises questions about such a system. And I think the system has its internal contradictions. I think Marx was very insightful about this. But you're right. Unless we get active, unless people who care get active, you're opening it up to God knows what directions an unraveling system will take. It's a little bit like an unraveling relationship or an unraveling individual. It can go in multiple directions and may depend a great deal on what key people say and do in these moments.
In our final minute here, I have learned, I think I've learned this from you, that capitalism in its several hundred year history now has been very good at getting through crises.
It has resources for that. It has mechanisms for that.
Does it get through this one?
That's the $1 million, $1 billion, yeah. $1 trillion question. And right now, I know from living in Manhattan and having been gone to the right school, so I know these folks, no one knows, and there's a great deal of anxiety about it.
And the idea, you'll correct me, Karl Marx, is you first need a great deep crisis that's really terrible for everyone before you have the conditions
set for
change.
Right, and it doesn't guarantee that those conditions will emerge or that the right outcome will happen. But that we're on the road to a crisis situation. That seems to be now established. The last 5 or 6 years since the crash of 2008 have made this abundantly clear, and it is even clearer in most of the rest of the world than it is here, because we are a little slow to face up as a nation to these difficulties.
So again, tonight you're going to be speaking at the First Presbyterian Church in Berkeley. That's at 2407 Dana Street, Berkeley, tonight, 7:30. You'll get to see Richard Wolf. What are you going to talk about? What are you going to talk about?
I'm going to be talking about where Trumponomics came from and where it's going.
Okay, so that is tonight. And I'm going to keep you with me here because you're also part of our KPFA family, so you can chime in if you want to help in the fundraising. Normally I say goodbye to a guest at this point, but folks, we are now, let me see here, we are now at $3,000.
Good.
And $2,000 to go. We have 2.5 minutes to make it. The number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. Our ability to have these type of radio programs on the air, including during our fund drive, is purely because of your support. Really, it's been my responsibility at KPFA to fundraise for Economic Update, and I discovered, like, hey, if I do these quick little, hey, folks, please pledge, and we'll keep bringing you the show you tune in for, well, people will do it because that's what they tune in for.
And let's feel good as a group, you and I, $3,000 in less than an hour. That's the kind of movement, that's the kind of momentum, that's the kind of solidarity amongst us that can make all the difference. We have a lot to be grateful for in what we've already achieved, and let it be an inspiration, as it ought to be, of what we're capable of.
1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. And again, what we're asking for is simple. We're calling it a pure donation. $25 pledge makes you a basic member to this radio station. A $100 pledge is what we have to really be able to average if we're going to make our goal. But that can mean, you know, several people, which we see happening, pledging $25 or $50, whatever is appropriate for them. And then somebody else who could pledge $500 because that's appropriate for them, or $1,000. And you know, this is free for everyone. And it's important that it remains that way. And it's free for everyone, not because we take commercials like other broadcasters, not because we take corporate underwriting. It's free for everyone because of listeners who step up, who see this as a civic responsibility to ensure that these type of conversations happen. And it's important to me that you make a donation, as you were saying, Richard, that people feel good about. I don't want you to bust the bank. Don't want you to make it hard to make ends meet at the end of the month. I want you to do what's appropriate for you. And if you are one of those people that can't do it right now, well, look, I look forward to that day in the future where you can. But until then, please, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. We're down to our final 5 seconds. I'm very thankful to you, Professor Wolf.
And I'm thankful.